They call it the Golden State. $50 billion of that gold is grown by the state's farmers every year. That so much is at stake in the nation's Golden State leads us to ask, how can California farmers keep growing all that gold?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned in to the 1293rd edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends up there in St. Petersport who are tuned in to the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, begin with the Mediterranean climate. Add a long range of mountains to collect and store winter's precipitation. Carve out a deep valley at the foot of those mountains, and then add to that valley some rich alluvial soils. It is a fact. The nation's Golden State was designed and built for agriculture. Stand back and have a look. California's 77,000 farms and ranches produce nearly $50 billion of revenue a year, and that's nearly double the revenue produced by number two, Iowa. The state's farmers and ranchers grow more than 400 commodities, including a huge percentage of the nation's fruits, vegetables, and nuts. Though agriculture has done its part in maintaining California's golden glow, it must compete with other interests for the state's resources. And this competition leads many to ask, how can California farmers keep growing that gold? Who better to ask than the person standing watch over California's $50 billion a year agriculture? That would be Karen Ross, who is California's Secretary of Agriculture. Karen, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be with you for a few minutes today.
We wonder, Karen, how is it that a farm girl from the Cornhusker state of Nebraska would end up standing watch over California's $50 billion a year agriculture? Must be an interesting story there.
I don't know how interesting it is, but I will start by saying it's because I'm one of the luckiest people you'll ever meet. To be able to move to this state and to learn from farmers and ranchers and to share my passion for what they do and connect it to consumers and every Californian that depends on ag for this healthy California-grown food and beverage sector that we have.
And there you
go. It was a long, torturous pathway. I'll just leave it at that, but I'm happy to go into details. I don't want to bore people.
Yeah, there you go. Well, I might pick your brain just a little bit on that, but first of all, what does a Secretary of Agriculture do?
Oh, that is a great question. We do a lot of meetings. We have a really great department with very committed staff members. Our core functions are really about excluding and preventing invasive species and animal diseases from entering the state, and having the detection systems in place and the protections in place to detect them immediately so we can rapidly respond. That's absolutely critical. When we think about 2 years ago, we went through a two-year battle with virulent Newcastle's disease, which can wipe out an entire state's population of poultry, or, you know, all of our bug issues that like to come to California like people do because of our Mediterranean climate and all the good things to eat. So we have extensive programs for that. I oversee fairs and expositions. We have division of weights and measures to make sure that in the stream of commerce, there's fair competition and there's consumer protections in places. And we have food safety programs and inspection programs, and we have a whole menu of climate smart agriculture programs as we transition to a carbon neutral economy in the state of California.
Well, good. Now, back to Nebraska and that Cornhusker farm girl. What did you learn growing up on a farm in agriculture in Nebraska that helps you, you know, negotiate the incredible amount of politics that you must have survived for the past 10 years in California here.
Oh, I don't know that I learned anything about politics on the farm, but I did. That's my values came from being a farm kid. In the summertime, I farm, I ran tractors just like my three younger brothers did, hauled hay, chased cattle, you name it. We did all of that. I was a 4-H kid. And so just really learned about the seasons and Mother Nature is the ruler. My dad was so committed and always pioneering on conservation practices and trying to learn more about how to do things better and differently. My mom died when I was 14, and a lot of the people in that very sparsely populated rural community had a direct hand in supporting my dad and myself and my three younger brothers. So just, community and working together and valuing every person for what they are. And moving to California was a bit of an eye-opening experience because how urbanized we are. But the strong environmental movement in this state has really informed a lot of the ways that I approach things. And it's about bringing people together to focus on all the things we have in common, as opposed to starting with where we might have our differences.
Well, good. Hopefully you can do that during this show, too, because we need a lot of bringing together these days, and much appreciated. Now, In considering how to approach this show, I called around and asked people in agriculture here on the Central Coast what questions I might ask Karen Ross. Mm-hmm. And it kind of boiled down to one question, which is, with the current tax, legal, and regulatory environments in California, how can the state stop losing the innovation and brain trust which makes it a leader in agriculture to other states and other nations? And rather than having you answer that, I think what we'll do is dig into the program today and hopefully that question will percolate around and we'll all come up with a consensus answer. How can we keep growing the gold for California? Well, Secretary of Agriculture Karen Ross, we've just been through, or hopefully we're through, the pandemonium of a pandemic. What did you see happen with our agriculture as we went through that?
I think we saw, as did our consumers, that there were huge disruptions in the supply chain. And even though there would be weeks at a time where you were rationed on toilet paper, food continued to be delivered to the store, especially all that glorious fresh produce. The wine kept going to the store. The milk kept getting to the store, even if it might run out at the end of the day, because farmers and farm workers are essential. They're an essential part of our infrastructure. They are essential workers, and they couldn't stay home. You can't milk cows or harvest crops from a desktop. You have to be there and you have to be doing it. And that's what farmers and ranchers and farm workers did throughout 2020. They made a lot of adjustments, but farmers on a daily basis are problem solvers. And that's exactly what they did. We worked with them. We scrambled to get the protective equipment. And the face masks and the gloves and the sanitizers for workers. We worked with them as soon as we could to get vaccinations. My department, working with our ag commissioners, distributed over 7.5 million face coverings and 2 million pairs of gloves. And, we just worked together to make sure that we could continue to harvest and send food to consumers, whether they shifted to online shopping or their grocery store. And in addition to that, our farmers actually increased the amount of food that they contributed to food banks. On an annual basis, they send about 160 million pounds of food to food banks as contributions, and that amount increased at a time when we had 8 million Californians, that many of them for the first time needed those food boxes.
Karen, was part of the reason for that great giving to the food banks. The fact that we couldn't sell it to the hospitality industry because it was shut down.
Absolutely. You know, people think that we get all of our food at the grocery store, but they forget about how critically important food service, which is the supplier to, you know, large institutional cafeterias, hotels, restaurants, entertainment parks, sporting venues. A bunch of California food gets featured and sold in those venues. And so that accounts for, you know, several million meals a day, including our school lunch program. So there was a huge pivot. And at the beginning of all of this, it was estimated that the ag industry could lose as much as $8 billion. Those numbers rapidly came down because of really creative partnerships in food and restaurant foods to go. Many of those restaurants became part of helping to supply school lunches to go to make sure that kids who depend on that school lunch program could get their food. We created a thing called Great Plates as a way to make sure seniors and people who couldn't leave their homes were able to get food delivery from our local restaurants, trying to think, how do we support farmers? How do we support restaurants? How do we support people who might not otherwise get this healthy food? It was a pretty complex process, but that food service, it's a critically important outlet and marketing channel for our food.
Well, that effort has been honored by the California Senate, which has named October as California Farmer and Farm Worker Month in perpetuity forever. October is going to be the month. That's pretty much, did you have a hand in that?
Well, I love it. A year ago, it seemed right at harvest time that we, working with California Grown, create October as California Farmer and Farm Worker Month as a way to honor all those people and all those hands that help get food to the table. And the governor did a letter recognizing that. And I'm thrilled that California Grown sought this resolution from the Senate, and they've decided October is exactly the right month to honor California-grown food, farmers, and farm workers.
And that's exactly what we're doing, because it is October, and we are
honoring. How about that?
Just like that, yes. And thank you for the great nudge from the folks at California-grown for bringing you to our attention, because we're going to enjoy the conversation we have today with Karen Ross, who is the Secretary of California Agriculture. She, a Cornhusker farm girl from Nebraska, now looking over a $50 billion industry just to make certain everything is going just right. And but things aren't going just right in a lot of different places. So we're going to pick those up when we come back and have a conversation about how farms and ranches and the CDFA, California Department of Food and Agriculture, how we can approach all of these challenges that we're looking at so that we can still keep growing that California gold, which is so precious to the Golden State. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What, with Karen Ross from Nebraska, now California. Right back.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
With Karen Ross, California's Secretary of Agriculture. And today we're looking at California as agriculture, marveling at what an incredible gift the good Lord gave the state in how he engineered the state of California. Karen, can you think of any place on earth that is more suitable to agriculture than California?
Sorry about that. I thought I had all my phones off. No, there is no place on earth as suitable for agriculture as California. And I've been blessed to have the opportunity to travel to many, major farm producing countries. And there's much we can do collaboratively, but we have the infrastructure, we have the intellectual capacity, we have this Mediterranean climate, which you mentioned. We invested in water systems. Obviously, we got to keep fine-tuning those and doing some adjustments with climate change. And we're leading on climate change, which is a huge impact to agriculture and food security if we don't approach it. And California is, and farmers and ranchers are leading with solutions.
Good.
The best place.
Now, in looking at all of the situations that confront agriculture right now, of immediate concern is a supply chain that seems to be constipated. Things aren't moving too well these days. Do you see this as a threat to agriculture's ability to keep growing the gold, or is it something temporary that's going to disappear by Tuesday?
Well, it's not going to disappear by Tuesday, and increasingly we're getting signals that this is going to go through into at least early 2022. It is one of many fragilities that we now know about with the disruption in the economy, the disruption that was caused in how people shop, and the disruption that was happening on a global basis taught us how interconnected we are. And what it means to have these super efficient, just-in-time manufacturing systems that all of a sudden we're thinking, maybe we need a bit of resiliency, which really means some level of redundancy. And who pays for that? Because we've really streamlined our systems to be as efficient as possible. How do we think about how much inventory should we have on hand? What I'm most concerned about now is what the long-term impact will be for agriculture. We have ships that are waiting to offload all kinds of manufactured consumer goods and parts that make our economy keep going, and they are being paid a great deal of money to get them here as soon as possible and turn around and go back to where they're manufactured as soon as possible instead of waiting to load up all of our agricultural exports. That could have long-term repercussions for ag. Not only that this is a peak time after harvest to ship a lot of our California crops, but it's impacting the pricing of those crops and has the potential of really softening or losing some of those hard-fought-for markets in Southeast Asia that are so critical to California agriculture. In a nutshell, it is a huge challenge. We are working desperately here with our federal counterparts on the entire supply chain coming together. Sorry for this long answer, but there's evidence that we're making some progress with Long Beach and LA going to 24/7 with cooperation from our important labor unions to be able to make that happen. But the whole supply chain has to adopt that because we've got backup of containers. We don't have enough truckers, we have backups at warehouses. So it's all connected, and we all have to work together to help solve this problem.
It seems like somebody in an F-150 Ford truck got a flat tire and everything stopped right on the freeway.
Yeah.
Nobody can move anywhere.
It's just like everything's just so bottled up. And the further out they have to go to find warehousing, that just adds more time, more delays. With some of the trucking rules that impacts the hours for trucking. I mean, this whole thing, who knew that when we pulled a thread on this sweater, the whole sweater could be like really threadbare, right?
There you go. It's truly amazing. You know, I was thinking, if I could give you a magic wand, which problem would you solve first for California agriculture?
If I could, a water.
Our water, of course, which always turns up to be the number one problem in California. And there's a lot of different elements to that problem, is there not?
That's right. Exactly right.
So what the first, I guess, would be, do we have enough water? How can we get enough water? And why don't we have enough water?
It is connected to climate change. It's also connected to there's no one answer. It's not a silver bullet. It's silver buckshot. You know, when we released the water resiliency portfolio in 2020, it identified 100 different actions that can be taken to improve statewide and regional resiliency. And it starts with really understanding how climate is impacting our historic water systems, which is that snowpack you mentioned. You know, in the drought in 2014 through 2017, we had a year with no snowpack. And this year in 2020, we had average snowpack, but we had warmer temperatures, rapid melt of that snowpack, and the dryness in our soil and our soils and the watersheds effectively eliminated any of the 800,000 acre feet of runoff that we typically would have coming into our reservoirs and then feeding our canal systems around the state. So we have to think about our systems, what kind of moisture events we're going to have, and do we have the right infrastructure for that? We still need our above ground storage. We really have to focus on below ground storage and exciting work that's happening on farms and in the valley with capturing peak flood flows from atmospheric rivers and storing those underground to restore our aquifers. We have to think more broadly about recycle, reuse, repurpose our water. We have to think more seriously about desalinization, not only large scale plants, but also mobile units for brackish water treatment in the valley. And we have to continue our really tremendous efforts on conservation, including the amazing work that's happening in agriculture to reduce our overall water use and at the same time increase our productivity. And that's happened. PPIC last year said we use 14% less applied water with an increase in productivity of 38%. That's a pretty astounding statistic when you think about it.
You know, we were driving down the Salinas Valley here a week or two ago, and somebody mm-hmm. was using overhead sprinklers. And mm-hmm. my wife said, what the heck are they thinking using overhead sprinklers? But what she was really pointing out is that that's the way it used to be done, and it is no longer done that way. We really, really fine-tuned our irrigation practices with drip lines and micro-sprinklers and whatnot, and agriculture has really stepped up to the plate on that one because water's expensive. Now, California voters some time ago, a few years ago, passed a mm-hmm. water bond that to expand the water infrastructure, especially with respect to surface water. Mm-hmm. Where are we with spending that money?
Yeah, so that the bond measure laid out the criteria for public funding for that storage. It dedicated $2.7 billion in Prop 1 for storage, and the process it had to go through at the Water Commission to identify up to 50% of the projects must show public benefit for the public funding. And these are big, complex projects. 7 projects have been approved through the Water Commission. They are all in various states of implementation. Some of those projects, you know, were feasible on paper, but putting together the additional financing, doing the environmental compliance work and getting the permits is where most of those projects are. But it will add significant storage to the state of California when those projects come to fruition. It's just big projects take a number of years to put into place.
Do you wish we could build dams like the Chinese build dams?
Well, having been to China and seeing some of their construction processes with very little environmental and labor protection, I'm not sure that's where we want to go. I'll just leave it at that.
There you
go. But we do need to invest in our infrastructure.
Good. And like you mentioned, there are other elements of the water situation that really come to bear too. But we note that you're working with some interesting initiatives there at CDFA and California legislature to, make things better. And one of them is the climate smart farming, which takes us into the whole issue of agriculture and farming. And there's a number of elements to that as well. You mentioned the fact that climate is having a big impact on the changes in California agriculture. Could you kind of give us a thumbnail of what you see in that respect?
Yeah, so obviously the impact to water, the loss of snowpack is a huge impact we're seeing. We're also seeing just increased heat days, which impact our workers, our valuable farm workers, and also can have impact to crops. We have seen the impact on chill hours and the loss of chill hours that are very important for a number of our fruit crops. But the increasing temperatures at nighttime, which has a big impact on our wine grape sector. And then with all of the wildfires, and it's not just the wildfires' direct impact on our agricultural lands. When we think about those wildfires and the impact to tourism and wine country and what shuts down tasting rooms, when we think about smoke paint and our wine grapes. And last year where we had because we had so many fires in so many parts of the state, in the Central Valley, they had almost 30 days of continuous smoke cover that actually interfered with some of the photosynthesis activities. So those are just a few of the ways that we know people, animals, and our ag lands are impacted by what we're already starting to see in climate change.
Well, how then is CDFA and the California legislature addressing this need to confront the environment and the changes in the environment? What
sure.
are we going to do to fix it?
Yeah. So, at writ large, obviously the move to carbon neutrality and identifying alternative energy to less carbon intensive energy, whether that's renewable biofuels or going to wind and solar, are going to be hugely important. The moves to electrify transportation, hugely important. But agriculture and forestry are the two sectors that can actually lead with going to a negative carbon, because we can sequester carbon with our land practices, our forestry practices, and our farming practices. That ability to draw down carbon, store it in our soils, and keep it there is a huge part of helping to get us to carbon neutrality. And so a lot of our work is around climate smart agriculture, which is about soil health. It's about using our water and all inputs more precisely, and about reducing methane. And our dairy families have done a fabulous job of embracing methane reduction strategies, whether it's dairy digesters to create renewable energy and low carbon transportation fuels, or alternative manure management practices to help get compost, that nutrient-rich waste product, to composting and helping with our soil health. Those are the kinds of programs that we're investing in with our farmers through incentive programs, technical assistance, and demonstration projects.
Well, how does that impact the farmer in the field who has a diesel tractor and a diesel truck to haul things to market with? What impact are these changes going to have on farmers and ranchers?
Sure. So we have a longstanding engine replacement program at the Air Resources Board. This past year, with the budget that Governor Newsom signed in early October, we have $363 million that's being added to that farmer program. It's called Farmer Program, which is the engine replacement program, as a way to cost share for the replacement of engines. We're phasing out ag burning, and we have $180 million Available for alternatives to ag burning, including whole orchard recycling to keep that carbon in the soil when we pull out, you know, an orchard and grind it and chip it and put it back into the soils. We have $100 million for our on-farm water use efficiency program, $160 million over the next 2 years for our healthy soils program, $80 million for our methane reduction program. So we're making investment in supporting agriculture in the transition over the next decade and a half to this carbon neutral economy that we all aspire to.
Okay, so farmers are going to have to make some changes, might have to get a new truck, new tractor, but the California government is going to be behind them and help them out making these changes, and maybe we can get the job done. You know, Karen, it confounds me the extent to which, and this is a little bit of editorializing, I guess, the extent to which we have gone to clean up our environment. And we've done that at the expense of losing a lot of our industry. We chase away industry that's dirty. But then we've taken to going down to the box store and buying made in China because it's cheap. And so I don't know if we've actually reduced our carbon output at all. We just shifted it over to China, along with our money. Your thoughts?
That's why it's so important to support California grown. We not only grow the highest quality, the widest diversity and bounty of so many different crops, 400, as you pointed out in your introduction. We grow it to the highest environmental and labor standards, which consumers are increasingly holding companies accountable for that. And consumers, with their pocketbook and how they vote, have a huge influence on the ability of keeping California-grown, healthy food and farm products on our shelves and in their pantries, well, and on the restaurant menu.
You hit that one out of the park, didn't you? Wow. We're going to take a quick break. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with Karen Ross and you right back.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city, for the city.
Port Ideas, Greg Williams.
There's a tremendous amount of useful information in MetroFarm for farming in or near the city.
Acres USA's Charles Walters.
MetroFarm tells how to convert an opportunity into a real going concern. Every chapter is organized around the logic of practicality. For every problem needing a solution, MetroFarm offers a progression of steps arranged in sequence so the desired goal is achieved.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning MetroFarm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
When you buy local American-grown flowers, flowers will grow and flourish in America. Hello, I'm Deborah Prinzing, author of Slow Flowers for Certified American-Grown Flowers. When you buy local flowers, you're helping our country's family farms reduce the transportation footprint of flowers and enjoy fresher, longer-lasting bouquets. So please, next time you shop for flowers, think local. Think Certified American-Grown Flowers. Visit AmericanGrownFlowers.org to learn more.
Hi, folks. How many of you out there love to garden? Wouldn't it be nice to grow some of your own food? Or maybe a flower garden would brighten your day. Well, now you can have the pleasures of gardening without all that effort. You don't need a tractor. You don't need a rototiller. All you need is the Knox Garden Box, a heavily constructed, portable, elevated garden on legs that can virtually change the way you've gardened in the past. The Knox Garden Box can be set up anywhere. Yes, you can place it right on concrete. For those with bad backs, you've got critters and gophers, no space or maybe no dirt. With the Knox Garden Box, the therapy of garden is now the prescription for good mental health. The way to find your fabulous Knox Garden Box is by logging on to KnoxGardenBox.com. That's KNOX GardenBox.com. or by calling 831-461-9430.
Business owners, get money you need in 2 to 3 days at businessmoneytogo.com. Business Money To Go is a network of reputable small business lenders that compete to lend you money. When you qualify with a one-page application, Business Money To Go will get you the best loan at the best rate in 2 to 3 days. Get $5,000 to $500,000 in 2 to 3 days at businessmoneytogo.com. businessmoneytogo.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it. On the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Today we have the big question on the table, which is, how can California farmers and ranchers keep growing all that gold? Think of it, ladies and gentlemen. We, our farmers and ranchers, grow $50 billion worth of food every year. 400 crops. Man, it's just extraordinary. Part of the reason we're able to do that is that the good Lord left us with a perfect place to do it. And that is the landscape of California. Wow, doesn't get any better anywhere in the world than California. And of course, the other reason is we have some very smart people out in the fields growing and harvesting our crops. And there's a lot of labor in that, which brings us to the issue of labor and the costs of labor for farmers. Can farmers continue to grow and prosper given the cost and difficulty of finding labor? Karen Ross?
Hey, thank you, Michael. So that's a pretty open-ended question. Was that my question?
Yes, it was.
Yes. How can we do this? There's no doubt that as California values drive policy and policy changes. The desire for living wages that have increased minimum wage as well as overtime regulations that changed dramatically for agriculture have really pushed us to the economics to invest more in automation and technology. And this is where there's a lot of excitement, especially from our young people who view ag in a very different light because of automation technology. They want to be the next programmers of the next app or the next thing or be the drone operator or whatever it might be. And so we are seeing a rapid increase in the investment in automation. Western Growers has and several of our commodity groups have a global automation initiative to really accelerate the development of that technology and really capitalizing on the intellectual capacity of this state with some of the finest universities and the greatest public university that is a land-grant university, UC and our CSU system, to really like create the next generation of automation for agriculture and ag tech here in California, where we can also become the custom manufacturing of all of that kind of equipment and all of those kinds of gadgets, and invest concurrently in workforce development with the skills that will be necessary to run all of that, as well as the specializations that we find ourselves increasingly faced with. Food safety specialists in the field and in the processing plant, irrigation specialists. So we do not see a lot of families in the state raising their children to be farm workers. We're seeing less and less numbers coming across the border, except for our H-2A program, which is also complex and expensive. So this shift to automation and technology that will free up those skilled workers to do the manual labor that we've historically had at large numbers is where our future is going to be on this particular aspect. It's going to take a decade. It's not going to happen overnight, but there's a lot of training and workforce development along the way that can happen as we improve our field processes.
And in the interim, we're still trying to figure out how to pick a red ripe strawberry, right? With a machine.
Yeah.
And good luck on that.
Sensor technology. Yeah. Sensor technology will be a part of it. But yeah. That's why honoring farmers and farm workers in October for California Grown is so important. Let's honor that work. Let's show the respect of that work. is justified to have.
Amen to that. Now, with respect to all of the people now pouring across the border, do you think any of them or many of them or a high percentage of them might possibly want to work on our farms?
Well, given what I hear from every sector across the economy, there's a lot of competition for workers in every sector, and especially in agriculture. We have seen in the last 8 years in particular a dramatic increase in the utilization of the H-2A program, which is a federal temporary worker program specifically for agriculture. It has its own complications, and it's very bureaucratic process to go through. It includes, you know, housing and transportation requirements, and you know the situation with housing, especially in our rural communities. But we've seen a dramatic increase in using that program to have a legal temporary workforce at the right times for our many specialty crops, and I think we'll continue to see that. We need additional reform there, and we need immigration reform to help give us that kind of a robust, effective temporary ag worker program.
Have you any thoughts about the possible reintroduction of the Bracero program?
It's historically been called Ag Jobs. It's reforming the H-2A program to make it work much more in a much more timely, less bureaucratic way, and has been embraced by a broad cross section of agriculture employers, unions, the faith-based community, and that's still where we put our hope in anything Congress might be able to do.
There you go. I guess another huge issue confronting agriculture is food safety. And over the past 10, 20 years, we've run into significant problems with food contaminations. And how is that playing out in agriculture? How are we coming to grips with that?
It's a tremendous change in our food safety programs. The Food Safety Modernization Act passed more than 10 years ago. It's such a change and so complex. Not all of the rules and procedures have been written yet by the Food and Drug Administration. Our state departments of agriculture have a very strong collaborative partnership with the Food and Drug Administration. We're actually the boots on the ground for this program as far as doing the education, outreach, and training. We're now in the inspection and audit phase. I have to give great kudos. Again, this is a hallmark of California agriculture, innovation, get the job done, adaptation. The Leafy Green Marketing Agreement has really set the standard in the metrics, the training, the science that's required, and implementing practices to try to eliminate, if that's ever possible, every type of foodborne illness that's possible. We've made great improvements and continue to invest in the science, the training, the education, to be able to prevent foodborne illness rather than respond to foodborne illness. And that's a big, gargantuan undertaking.
Here on the Central Coast, we've seen an interesting phenomenon whereby one farmer will try to get rid of all elements of nature so as to reduce the possible contamination as much as possible. And then a neighbor down the road will be planting hedgerows and encouraging beneficial insects and whatnot, and pretty much heading in the opposite direction. Have you any thoughts on that?
So this has been a 10-year phenomena, and it just shows the complexity and the interconnectedness throughout our food system. We have, on the one hand, this enthusiasm for certified regenerative organic agriculture, which actually has animals on the farm, and trying to help our retailers who are interested in these kinds of programs. The challenge with our Food Safety Modernization Act, We want to increase and divert even more organic waste out of landfills and send it to composting. And we have to ensure that composting is held to rigorous standards because of the potential for soil amendments and compost to be a carrier. We have to look at our water sources and understand how they are interconnected and how we can actually prevent foodborne illness because of all the inputs that come onto our farms that could be the carrier. So it's hugely complex. It's coming at a time where one policy may be in complete contradiction with another, and it's our job as folks who understand the agronomic practices to be able to inform our sister agencies about these issues.
And we,
spend a lot of time doing that.
It's probably a big part of your job. And, you know, people got to realize that when you say complexity, we're talking 77,000 farms, different farms and ranches in California.
Yes.
And as you said earlier, that really, something that really caught my attention, that farming and ranching is a business of problem solving all the time. When you get up and go to work in the morning, it's one problem after another that you have to figure out how to contend with. And of course, with 77,000 farms, you have 77,000 farmers and ranchers figuring out how to do this. And so the complexity is very complex indeed. My goodness.
It truly is. And then you add yet another dimension, which is also what makes California agriculture such an exciting part of our economy and our culture in California, the diversity of farms and farm practices. So we have many, many very small farms, less than 20 acres, and we have many, many multi-generation farms that are in the tens of thousands of acres. And different levels of sophistication and practices. Some are vertically integrated. That's how they were able to support the next generation coming to the farm. Some that just grew by acreage. Some that focus on just shipping to the restaurant down the road or the farmer's market. And some that thrive on shipping their product around the world. So you add all of that in there and making sure that there is a place for every farmer in California agriculture. And one of the ways we're working at the state level to support many of those small farms is the introduction of farm to school and really trying to increase local procurement by these large scale institutions, starting with our schools, to be better connected to what's grown locally and supporting small farms and improving the nutrition on that lunch plate at school every day and helping our students connect to agriculture and understand climate and the environment. It's a pretty exciting program.
There you go. And speaking of exciting, California has what amounts to a brand new crop industry in cannabis that's legal, but not really. How is CDFA and the legislature approaching this whole new strange industry that we have?
Well, the first step was to legalize it so that we could regulate it and, of course, tax it. When the program was first stood up, the California Department of Food and Agriculture had the licensing of cultivation. We also hosted the track and trace system so that we could follow it all the way from the seedling to the first point of sale in the distribution channel. Since that time, just this past summer, we have consolidated our role, which is on cultivation, the role of the Department of Food and Health, which is on the laboratory and public health aspects, into one Department of Cannabis Control, which is housed at our Business, Consumer Services, and Housing Agency. So we have just been in the transfer of that program to that new department. We have two elements that are left behind at the Department of Food and Agriculture, an Appalachians program that is being stood up as we speak, and an OCAL program, which is a cannabis-certified organic program that's still housed at the Department of Food and Agriculture. And in the meantime, we try to work with our local governments when asked on the interface of cannabis with our other with our other crops as part of the agricultural landscape.
Well, Agriculture Secretary Karen Ross, it would appear as though farmers and ranchers and everybody has a lot to face up to in order to keep growing $50 billion worth of California gold every year. And it appears as though everybody's doing their best to get there. But what can we do to help? And I think you've already brought that up, but you may as well bring it up again. What can we do to help?
I would love to. Thank you, Michael. We can all help by looking for and supporting California grown. So I encourage your consumers when they're thinking about their next bottle of wine or local brew or dairy product, meat product, and all the wonderful specialty crops, including flowers in the state, that they check out the California Grown website, which is californiagrown.org. We've got a whole section on resources to support farmers, farm workers, and California grown, including a beautiful calendar to understand the seasons when everything's in peak season and flavor, resources for kids, and all kinds of recipes and beautiful, beautiful ways to use and combine California grown crops. Thank you for letting me put that little plug
in. No problem. And there you go, folks. She is Karen Ross, Cornhusker farm girl from the great state of Nebraska, now the Secretary of California's Agriculture. Thank you so much, Karen.
Thanks, Michael. I really enjoyed the visit. Good luck to everyone.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.